Young, it's here and now. Coming up, three African Americans hope to become the country's third black governor in history. Can you name the previous two? We'll learn more about America's history of black governors. But first, the campaigns, all of them, head into the home stretch. President Bush stumped for Western Republicans today amid more troubling numbers in a new CBS New York Times poll. It shows only 29% of Americans approve of the president's handling of the Iraq War, numbers equaling the lowest of the Bush presidency. The poll also shows most Americans believe U.S. troops will come home sooner if the Democrats control Congress. Well, while the president is out west, it's clear that Ohio may again be an election bellwether because so many Republican seats once thought to be safe are now up for grabs. Jonathan Riskin is Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. He joins us from Columbus, Ohio. And first of all, how has this happened? Is it a surprise that Ohio is this contentious?
I think that there were a lot of expectations all along that Ohio would be fairly important. There's been several congressional seats that were targeted, I think, from the start, including right here in the Columbus area, Representative Deborah Price, who's the fourth-ranking House leader. And she's in a district that President Bush actually lost in by about 1,000 votes in 2004. And I think over the last year or so, year and a half, as the Iraq War has become, as you noted in your poll numbers there, has become progressively more unpopular among many Americans, I think the feeling was by National Democrats that they could target some of the more moderate congressional districts in Ohio and be competitive. And then the other thing that is happening in Ohio, of course, is that there's been a lot of state house scandals around Ohio Republicans who have controlled the apparatus of state government for going on 16 years now, since 1990. And then on the federal level, of course, there's Representative Bob Ney, who's pleaded guilty to federal corruption charges. That's in a district just east of Columbus. And the Republican running there, Joy Padgett, is having a lot of trouble trying to hold on to that seat for the Republicans. So there's a lot going on in Ohio. There's about three or four congressional races that Democrats think they have a chance in to at least win a couple of them. And, of course, Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio is down in virtually every public poll that I've seen, down 6-7 or more points to Democrat Sherrod Brown statewide.
Well, let's talk about Deborah Price. You mentioned, again, the fourth-ranking member of the House Republican leadership, a moderate. She's facing Mary Jo Kilroy, a Democratic challenger who's also a local county commissioner. And you followed in one of your articles Deborah Price as she went from house to house, preaching the Republican mantra, warning of dire consequences, higher taxes, Hollywood values, the country becoming a haven for terrorists, should her Democratic challenger win. How is that resonating?
It's a moderate district, and I think what Price is counting on, what Republicans are counting on to pull out some of these races, is turning out the Republican vote in a midterm election that they still believe independents won't vote in great numbers. In 2004, Democrats did, I think by everybody's measure, a great job of turning out their voters. It's just that Republicans in Ohio turned out even more voters, and so Bush famously won the state by a fairly narrow margin. And right now, the Republicans are worried that they could get swamped if their voters are discouraged and believe they're going to lose. There's a gubernatorial candidate at the top of the ticket, Ken Blackwell, down by big double digits in the race for governor, and Republicans are worried they've got to get out their vote. And the only way to do that is to motivate their base by saying things like, you know, higher taxes, and I'm sticking with the president on Iraq, and so forth. And of course, the danger there in a moderate district is it's not going to resonate with independents, most likely. The question is, can someone like Price turn out enough of a Republican vote to pull it out?
And you quote a Republican who's been campaigning door-to-door as well, this is in Franklin County, saying that there's fatigue among Republicans. What do they mean?
I think there's been so much scandal in Ohio around Republicans, and Republicans have controlled the apparatus of state government here, and which is based, of course, here in Columbus, since 1990. And I think Republicans are worried that, you know, it's just sort of, in one sense, almost an inevitable swinging back of the pendulum. And on top of that, all these scandals surrounding Governor Bob Taft, Bob Ney. Right now, at this moment, there's a trial going on in Toledo involving a figure named Tom Noe, who allegedly embezzled millions of dollars in a rare coin investment from the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. They're really worried that all of that is just that Republican voters have just become sort of tired of the whole thing and discouraged, and they won't come out in their usual numbers.
Jonathan Riskin, Washington Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, speaking to us from Columbus. But Jonathan, as you said, the Republicans are not writing anything off.
They're not writing anything off, at least publicly. There are some races, for instance, the race to try to hold on to the nay seat. I think privately they're starting to concede that. They're not writing anything off, but they're clearly worried.
Jonathan, thank you.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, while congressional races are getting most of the attention right now, as former Speaker Tip O'Neill once said, and it's almost required to repeat at least once during an election, all politics is local. And if a wave forms as predicted, Democrats could win a majority of state gubernatorial offices for the first time since 1990, even in states like Ohio, New York, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts that have had Republican governors for a number of years. A few of these races remain close, and here to tell us about them is Jennifer Duffy. She's watching the campaigns for the Cook Political Report. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Do some of the math for us. You know, what are the states that are held? What are the states where governors are retiring or where Democrats are trying to hold on to seats? Just go through that for us.
Well, there are 36 races up this year. Republicans have the burden of defending 22 of those seats, and they have 9 open seats that they must defend. 5 of those are open because governors are forced to retire because of term limits. By contrast, Democrats only have 1 open seat that they need to defend, and that is in Iowa.
Well, let's take a look at some of these races, and we'll start out west. In the race in Nevada, it's between Republican Congressman Jim Gibbons and State Senator and Democrat Dina Titus. Gibbons had what's described as a slim but secure lead, but then on October 13th, Gibbons had a setback. Can you briefly tell us that story?
Well, apparently he and his media consultant and a couple of his supporters were in the bar of a restaurant because it was raining outside, and they were waiting for it to stop, and apparently they were joined by a woman and her friend who were very drunk, and apparently the woman now says that he escorted her to her car and assaulted her. But she's not a terribly credible witness. The 911 tapes portray somebody who is very, very drunk and refuses to file a complaint, then comes forward and tries to file one. Whether or not anything happened at all, this has been a major distraction for the Gibbons campaign for the last 2 weeks. And we've seen this race close some. He is still ahead, but it has definitely gotten much tighter.
Well, another race that's too close to call right now is in Maryland, where Republican Governor Robert Ehrlich's re-election bid against Baltimore Mayor Martin O'Malley seems to be in trouble. Ehrlich is popular with voters, but it looks as if he's behind in the polls. What's going on there?
Well, I think Maryland is a very good example of what's going on. It's a very blue state. Voters don't think that Ehrlich has done a bad job, but in a year where the climate is so bad for Republicans, he has fallen behind. There are a couple of recent polls that show very, very different results. There was a poll from the Washington Post on Sunday that showed him down 10 points, but there was also a poll from the Baltimore Sun that showed the race dead even. And so it's a little bit tough to see exactly where this is. I think, though, that Governor Ehrlich is at a bit of a disadvantage here.
And is it because of the same issues we're hearing about in the Senate and House races, the war in Iraq or the Mark Foley fallout?
I think that it does have something to do with that. I mean, how else do you explain a governor who voters think is doing a good job, yet is trailing in the polls?
Well, meanwhile, he is trying to bring the issues back home with ads like this one, characterizing his challenger, Baltimore Mayor Martin O'Malley, as ineffective on crime. Let's listen.
O'Malley was caught manipulating crime statistics to make the city look safer, and he's gone through 7 police commissioners. While cities like New York have been able to get violent crime under control, O'Malley promised and failed. How can we trust him now?
Well, the most recent polls show that the gap between the candidates is narrowing. Is it thought that there's time for Governor Ehrlich to catch up with O'Malley?
There is time, and this is going to be one of those races where how the candidates do it, getting their voters to the polls, is going to be very, very important. Governor Ehrlich has focused on absentee ballot programs. He needs to win a lot of the suburban vote, both suburban Baltimore and suburban Washington, which is why you see these ads on crime.
Well, another race where the Republican administration's policy seemed to be trickling down to the State House is Rhode Island. Charlie Fogarty, the Democrat challenging incumbent Republican Governor Donald Cachiri. In recent TV ads, Fogarty pinning the war in Iraq on the sitting governor's lapels. Has that been effective, or, you know, going right at that topic?
I think in this case, maybe voters think that Fogarty went a step too far in trying to link Cachiri to Bush and to Bush's policies. Obviously, governors don't have any control over what goes on in this war. They don't have any say in the policy. In recent days, I have seen Cachiri's numbers improve, and I've seen him widen this gap, to maybe, 8 to 10 points.
Well, on the other hand, sitting Senator Lincoln Chafee is a little behind in the polls, and it said because of President Bush's record, even though Lincoln Chafee, the most liberal Republican in Congress.
That's right. Democrats there have made this race that even though you like Chafee and you'd like to vote for him, voting for Chafee means keeping Republicans in power.
That's funny. Two different impacts, two different races in the same state. Jennifer, give us some perspective here, because obviously the governorships are important to the individual states and the people there. But we also understand they're so important to the parties because these governors can sort of lay the groundwork for presidential campaigns.
Well, one governor can certainly help their party's presidential candidate. You assume a governor has a political base that he can put to work for their presidential candidate. The other important thing to remember about the governors, most of the governors elected this time, is that they'd be up for re-election in 2010, which would put most of them in charge of redistricting, which is important for the Congress.
Well, here in Massachusetts, we have a sitting governor, Mitt Romney, who's a rising Republican star. He's head of the Republican Governors Association. He's been campaigning for other gubernatorial candidates outside of Massachusetts, but could he have helped his lieutenant governor more? Kerry Healy is running to replace Romney and trailing in the polls to the Democratic challenger, Deval Patrick. Patrick is a former prosecutor who joined an effort to get a convicted rapist a DNA test. That test ultimately proved the man was guilty. Now, Healy's running ads pretty much characterizing Patrick as a friend to rapists.
I think Healy probably overdid her efforts on Patrick's record on crime. But here's the reality. You know, an outgoing governor cannot pick up his party's nominee and carry them across the finish line. They need to do that themselves. Healy has not run a great campaign here. I think she has made some mistakes, and I don't know that there's anything Romney could have done to correct that.
Jennifer Duffy follows the gubernatorial elections for the Cook Political Report. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's take a quick look at some of the other gubernatorial races. New York's Attorney General Eliot Spitzer leads Republican John Faso in the polls. The GOP appears to be on the verge of its worst defeat in New York State since World War II. In Pennsylvania, he's a Hall of Famer, but can he score on Tuesday? Republican Lynn Swann hopes to unseat Democrat and former Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell. One pollster has called Rendell untouchable. And in California, it's an uphill climb for Phil Angelides. The Democrat is facing incumbent Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's got a healthy lead and is also outspending the Democrat by more than 4-1. And the incumbent governor in Colorado has to leave office due to term limits. He'll be replaced by either Republican Bob Beaupre or Democrat Bill Ritter. Earlier, we mentioned the governor's race in Massachusetts. Come Tuesday, a little history will be made. The state could either have its first elected woman governor, Kerry Healy, or its first black governor, Deval Patrick. Coming up, a history lesson on black governors in the U.S. Did you know about the black governors from colonial times? Stay with us. More ahead here now. Robin Young, it's here and now. As we said, there are three African-American candidates in gubernatorial races around the country. Deval Patrick here in Massachusetts, Secretary of State Ken Blackwell in Ohio, and former Pittsburgh Steeler player Lynn Swann in Pennsylvania. If any of them win, they'll join a very small club. Only three black Americans have been American governors. Of course, Douglas Wilder governed the Commonwealth of Virginia from 1990 to 94. And then there was Pinckney Benton Stewart Pinchback. Pinchback was the son of a Mississippi white planter and a freed slave. He was acting governor of Louisiana for 35 days back in 1872. And then, even less known, were the so-called black governors in colonial New England. They were elected, had inaugural parades, they had the title of king or governor and assistants and sheriffs, but they were slaves who acted as mediators between the white and slave populations. Lewis Randell is very familiar with this chapter of American history. He's a retired school administrator from Vernon, Connecticut. He joins us now. And Mr. Randell, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know much about these black governors. Who were some of these men?
The first one was a gentleman named Hercules. That was in 1749 out of New London. And some of them that served, of course, there's 27 of them that served throughout the years, right up until, say, 1856, around that time.
And tell us, you know, because we've read different things now that we're, you know, looking into this, and we've heard on the one hand that they were co-opted by the white community to sort of subdue the slave population. On the other hand, we've heard that they were elected on what was called Election Day, a big day of parades and politicking for black and white communities. So which is true? Were they co-opted, or did they really represent the black communities?
Depends on who's writing it. Now, if the white writers wrote a comment like it was a mimicry type thing, but in research it shows that they were actually elected by their peers. And a lot of it involved the following day of the regular election day. And that's how that all came about, because a lot of them participated in going to their master's election.
What was their responsibility? What did they do?
One of the main functions was to maintain a liaison between the master and the people, help the individuals become involved in their own life. For example, if they have a problem in the family, they served as mediators. They also were advisors to the community.
We understand they ran education programs?
They ran education programs in the sense of helping further the education of individuals. They also, for example, would maintain a type of organization that brought to this country, they brought some of their own African studies to this country and put in the election type process of democracy.
Taught black people how to read, which was, there wouldn't be no other place for them to do that at that time.
Yes, that's true. And also, they also maintained their integrity by allowing more freedom of their election process.
Again, because they had experienced these democracies in Africa.
Yes.
Ironic. But were they also feared, because we understand that they sometimes acted as sheriffs for white masters tracking down runaways?
Well, I would think, they could have served that purpose. Some of them, of course, maintain order. Sometimes they were used in that process. But basically, it was more of a supportive role amongst the communities.
Well, now you go to historical societies and fraternal organizations, classrooms, to reenact some of these roles, telling these stories. Who's your favorite? Tell us a story you like to tell.
One favorite is Boston Trotro. He was a governor from, early 70s, 70s to 72.
That's Trotro, T-R-O-W-T-R-O-W? What's that name?
That name is an African name, and that was one of the key ingredients when you research these things. You find out they brought and used their own African name, and sometimes it had a meaning, and sometimes it didn't, but they used their own African name.
And what do you like about Boston Trotro?
Well, Boston Trotro was a man who had the opportunity to travel a little bit with his master and accompanied, the wealthy man's children to, say, Harvard. So he got to travel. So he got to listen. He got to hear some of the lectures. See, he might be outside by the window, but he was being educated by osmosis, in a sense, by hearing what was being said at Harvard at that time. So the fact that he took time out to do this and used it as part of his own pride and responsibility, he brought that kind of feeling back to his people.
Well, I know it's difficult for an actor or a reenactor to slip in and out of a role, but I'm wondering if you could, you know, speak to us in the voice of Boston Trotro in the way that you might when you speak before kids. Is that, can you do that?
Not really. What I usually tell them, first of all, I try to tie it into their current school setting. Mm-hmm. In other words, for example, I'm saying, I am now the governor, therefore I have some questions of you. Have you attended school? Have you been on time? How's your attendance been? Now, sometimes I get the wrong answers. For example, if I'm doing this in October and I ask that question, I would expect everyone to have perfect attendance, you see. So I try to portray the fact that this gentleman, say Boston Trotro, was a man who took his roles very serious, and because of what he did, gave the opportunity for the community of today to be at the same pace, working hard to better oneself, taking pride in responsibility.
When you were a young man, and again growing up in Norwich, Connecticut, what was it like for you to hear these stories?
Well, of course, unfortunately, as a youngster growing up, I didn't hear these stories. And I had an uneasy feeling when they'd be speaking about slavery in the classroom. And it would have been nice if I could have been told about these black governors who were part of the system, but also had a positive role in developing our nation.
Lewis Randall of Vernon, Connecticut, he tells the stories of the black governors of the colonial era. And Lewis, thanks so much for telling them to us.
Okay, you're welcome.
So evocative. You're listening to an original recording of the first national broadcast of Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings when it was played on November 5th, 1938. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll find out how the Adagio became a national treasure. Stay with us. That's tomorrow, but much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Young, It's Here and Now. British Prime Minister Tony Blair ignited a controversy last month when he disparaged the full-body veil that some Muslim women wear as a mark of separation. And yesterday, we had a conversation about that debate in Britain. Today, an American Muslim who has some strong thoughts on wearing the full veil in this country. And she's not just any Muslim. This past summer, 43-year-old Dr. Ingrid Mattson became the first woman and the first North American to be chosen president of the Islamic Society of North America. Ingrid Mattson was born a Roman Catholic in Canada and converted to Islam in college, and she wears a headscarf. Dr. Mattson is a professor at the oldest Islamic Studies Center in the U.S. at the Hartford Seminary in Connecticut, where she also directs the program to train Muslim chaplains. And she joins us from the studios of WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Nice to be speaking with you today.
Well, as we've talked about here on the program, Muslim women in Britain who wear the full veil in public, you know, leaving only their eyes exposed, have faced a lot of criticism from their government and people there. But you don't hear of that kind of thing in the U.S. Why do you think that is?
I think it's different here. The Muslim community in the United States is relatively privileged with respect to even communities in other parts of the world, of the democratic world, like Europe, in that the majority of Muslims who came here did so deliberately for economic advancement or for professional interest or to study. We also have a significant segment of our population, one-third to one-half, that is African-American, who considers this country theirs and whose view of pluralism is quite different. But I would say that the majority of the Muslim community in America is invested in the American dream and, in fact, perhaps is more disappointed than many other Americans that it seems that many Americans are willing to give in to fear to allow a weakening of the protections for minorities in this country.
Well, I want to ask you, as a Muslim woman living in the U.S., you wear a headscarf in public. Not all Muslim women choose to do that. Why did you, and what kind of reaction do you get here in the U.S.?
Well, I chose to wear a headscarf because I was convinced and remain convinced that it is something that the Quran requires of Muslim women. The reaction really, you know, perhaps because I'm in a privileged position, I'm a professional. I teach in an environment and work in an environment in which religion is important. So I don't face the same kind of barriers that some Muslim women may have in a corporate environment, for example, where certainly conformity in dress is important. So it's a challenge to tolerance and to various segments of American society to open up and accept exceptions for religious accommodations and religious observance.
How much also do you think Muslims should conform? You're well aware, I'm sure, of the ongoing debate in Britain. Some women in Britain agree with Prime Minister Blair that Muslims need to assimilate more. What do you think about here in the U.S.?
Well, I think we have to separate the issue into two areas.
Right.
One is, what should the state tolerate legally, constitutionally, and then what might be good practice that the community thinks is would reflect all of its values. And to that extent, Muslims should be like any other member of society and having complete freedom to dress as they like. I mean, if people in London can handle, young men walking around with 7-inch purple mohawks and multiple facial piercings, I don't think Muslims should be exempt from the tolerance that's extended.
Well, of course,
you know, I may not like it. I personally find the face veil off-putting in a Western context, but because of our cultural paradigms and our cultural associations with it.
Why? Because
the idea of a mask and a face cover is something that is often looked at as something insidious or hiding some nefarious intention. That's not the case in Muslim societies, where generally it's been a mark of distinction, so that even throughout Islamic history, some upper-class men have covered their face as a sign of their special status. But so these dress depends on the context. And personally, I would advise Muslim women, in my capacity as someone who's giving, advice to other Muslims, I'd say, really think about that. And many Muslim women I know who came to this country wearing a face veil and believed that that was a good practice eventually uncovered their face because they just found that they were getting such a negative reaction that they felt that it wasn't worth it. It's similar to shaking hands. You know, there are many conservative Muslims who believe that it's better for men and women who are unrelated not to have any physical contact. So that includes shaking hands. But I know many religious people, men and women, even, scholars and sheikhs and imams, who in this society will shake hands with the opposite gender because it is such a strong sign of friendliness, trust, openness in this society that to refrain from doing that, they feel would be simply too off-putting.
Hmm. This is fascinating. You say you would tell, in your role now, you would say to women not to do the full covering. What about your daughter? I know you have a daughter and a son. You met your Egyptian husband while teaching in Pakistan. What would you say to her about the hijab, the head covering, and then the full covering?
Well, my daughter decided to put on a headscarf, in fact, in 2001, a week before September 11th, when she was a middle schooler. And when that happened, I said to her, when she put it on, I said, look, you're still young. I want you to consider this practicing or experimenting so that you don't feel that if you later decide to take it off or that it's too difficult at this time, you don't feel that you've broken a promise or something like that. Just consider it experimenting. And then when September 11th happened, we talked to her seriously about, that it might not be the right time. We didn't know how the general public would react. But she's a very stubborn person, in fact, and she's the kind of person who said, well, if they're going to bother me because it, by golly, I'm going to wear it just to spite them. Will she change her mind? Will she look at things differently over her life? This is really her choice as she gets older, because it's not meaningful if it's imposed.
Dr. Ingrid Mattson, Director of Islamic Chaplaincy at the Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. She's also a professor there. This past summer, she became the first woman, the first North American, to head the Muslim umbrella group, the Islamic Society of North America. Dr. Mattson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
and you're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's getting to the end of the campaign trail. Time to calculate the number of candidates suffering from foot and mouth disease this election season. Of course, John Kerry is the latest. The senator from Massachusetts has canceled the rest of his campaign appearances after saying students who didn't study would get stuck in Iraq, as opposed to his scripted joke, students who didn't study could get us stuck in Iraq, just ask President Bush. Well, Los Angeles Times Washington correspondent Johanna Newman has been counting, tallying up what seems like an epidemic of political foot and mouth disease this season. She joins us now. Johanna, it does seem as if there's been more than usual this year.
Oh, my goodness. It's just been a plethora of apology. I think one of the reasons is that these videos on YouTube and other sources make the apology have a much longer life.
Right.
And so the loop is continuous and the mistake is never ending. And the apology is sort of worthless, to tell you the truth, but people keep trying.
Well, let's go back. Senator George Allen of Virginia, probably the most publicized comment prior to Senator Kerry's. Allen called a campaign worker for his opponent, Jim Webb, a macaca. Some say it's a racial slur. What are some of the other things that politicians have said this past campaign? Let's start with Tram Hudson.
Tram Hudson is a banker in Florida, and he was running for the House seat being vacated by Catherine Harris, who is now running for Senate. And he actually said, "I'm from Alabama, and I know blacks are not the greatest swimmers, may not even know how to swim."
How did that even come up?
I don't know how it came up, but what's interesting to me is that he later apologized. He didn't even win. He came in third in the primary.
Well, and you know, perhaps letting bubbles like that come out of your mouth, you know, would lead directly to a third-place finish.
This is not confined to Republicans. Denny Hoyer, who's a very high-up Democrat from Maryland, accused the GOP Senate candidate, an African-American named Michael Steele, said that he'd had a career of slavishly supporting the Republican Party.
He used the word slavishly.
He used the word slavishly, and Steele took great umbrage. Conservative bloggers went crazy. That happens in a lot of these. The radio talk shows, you know, go ballistic, or someone raises the red flag. The bloggers called it Macaca the sequel, and Hoyer had to apologize.
Well, another is Representative Barbara Cuban, a Republican of Wyoming, who told an opponent during a debate that she would slap him were he not disabled. He was sitting there in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Her opponents, of course, immediately turned around and ran an ad playing off that. Here's an excerpt.
Is that why Cuban threatened to slap her opponent when he pointed out that she'd taken money from convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff? Barbara Cuban, that's just a slap in the face to all of us.
Ouch!
A Cuban apologized. She said the stress of the campaign took its toll. How much is this, just the round-the-clock campaigning?
Well, there is some of that, but I think Cuban reminds us to mention one other point, Robin, which is that sometimes, as in the macaca case for George Allen, these things can have real political impact. And Cuban, who was way ahead in the polls, is now in neck-and-neck race with her Democratic opponent. But I do think that, you know, candidates get tired. This is an especially mean-spirited, nasty, high-stakes midterm election. And I think in Washington there's this old joke that the definition of a gaffe is a politician who says what he really thinks. And I think we're seeing some unscripted moments.
And one that was in that serious nature vein, Florida State Representative Ralph Azra left racial slurs in a threatening voicemail on another representative's voicemail. He says his actions were fueled by liquor, but obviously, you know, it stands.
Yeah. And, I mean, there's the guy who's running against Hillary Clinton in New York has just had a spate of poorly phrase utterings, which he's happened to make to reporters sitting next to him on airplanes, and they, of course, have gone right out and put these in the New York papers. He made some derogatory remarks about her appearance and said, you know, have you ever seen a picture of her when she was younger? Phew, I can't believe that Bill married her.
He's the one who said she's had, you know, surgery.
Yeah, and she offered to show reporters that she had no scars and so forth.
Because he's denied that he said these things, said he was taken out of context, but there may be a moral there about being careful who you sit next to.
Or get airplanes. A private jet, you know.
Or maybe just keep your mouth closed.
There you go.
Johanna Newman, Washington correspondent for the LA Times. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. The multicultural film Babel tells four stories in four places: Morocco, Los Angeles, Japan, and Mexico. And as in the biblical Tower of Babel, the film speaks in a multitude of languages, including sign, spoken by well-known international actors, including Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett as wealthy American tourists, lesser-known performers, and a good many non-actors as well. Here's a sampling of scenes and sounds from Babel.
Why can't you just relax? Why are you so stressed?
You know what the reason I'm stressed. You know the reason why I can't relax.
Good if you try.
What did you do with you?
I'm
not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not
going to do
it.
Babel director Alejandro González Iñárritu won the Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival this year. Entertainment Weekly says it could be a dark horse candidate for an Oscar. Iñárritu was in Boston last month, and we asked him to explain how all of these seemingly different stories in the film interconnect. Now, we don't want to give away the tangled web they weave, except to say a Japanese father and his deaf-mute daughter and a Mexican nanny are somehow linked to two small Moroccan boys who've been given a gun to guard their goats.
Basically, the characters made wrong decisions. You know, the kids innocently do something that will, you know, a bullet will have an echo. You know,
echo around
echo,
the world.
The echo will travel through Japan and Mexico and United States. You know, but it's all of the characters made wrong choices based on ignorance, irresponsibility, or innocence, and then there's consequences about
right.
it.
Well, let's explain. The Moroccan youth are given this rifle to help guard their goats, but they want to see if they can fire a shot at a bus. To hit the bus. In the bus is the American tourist couple. She is hit, and they are stranded in this Moroccan village. Meanwhile, back in California, their nanny makes a decision to, she desperately wants to go to her son's wedding across the border from San Diego in Mexico, and she takes the charges of the American couple who are stuck in Morocco. And then we are in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the thing is that I think we are living in a world that every decision that we made in a world like the chaos theory about the wings of the butterfly spread in Tokyo is true that makes a storm in New York one day later. And I think, you know, these characters will never see each other physically and they will never interconnect, but they are emotionally attached. And that's the way we are living now in the TV and the internet. I think every decision that we make have a tsunami effect in maybe 20,000 miles away from
right.
here.
Well, and some of these ways in which people emotionally connected, I almost couldn't watch. They were so profound. I mean, there's one moment where the husband and wife, and we are not going to give this away, but there's obviously something between them unresolved, and yet here he is desperately trying to save her life while they lay on a little mud hut in Morocco. And there's a villager. The villager tries to sew up her neck, sew up her wound.
Okay, yeah, well, he has to stitch up, you know? And all these people, the most interesting part of me of this journey was that 90% of the actors, beside obviously Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett, 90% of all the people that you will see are non-actors, and there are real people from these humble communities without electricity that have never seen a camera, and they were really just doing what they normally do in their real lives. And that was a really interesting combination, you know what I mean? And very, very difficult challenge for me. But at the same time, for the actors, it was a real experience. We were living under the conditions very close to the subject matter of the film.
Well, you know, you pick that up because they seem to just be staring as people would if suddenly a couple from San Diego on a tour bus was plopped in their midst and they'd never seen Westerners before. It felt that way. And in this one scene, they're trying to patch up her wound. Mm-hmm. And there's something so intimate. No, they didn't understand each other's languages, but there was something extended there that was so interesting.
Yeah, and traveling all around, suddenly I realized I thought that I was doing a film about the differences between human beings, what separate us, and suddenly I realized that I was doing a film about what brings us together, which is pain, you know, and I think that this film basically is about compassion. And I felt a lot of compassion for all the people that I work with, and I feel that all the audiences, the response that I have get is that you feel compassion, you are seeing a film of human beings, beyond the fact that you are watching Japanese, Moroccan, Mexican, without prejudice. Because I think that this film, too, talks about the borders, and not the physical borders, the ones that we construct, but the real borderlines that are within ourselves, which are the most dangerous ones. And those kind of borderlines, the only way that we can really cross that is true love. That's the only way.
Obviously, the title, Babel, relates to the biblical story. What does that mean to you? What does the biblical story mean to you?
Well, I think in the Genesis, in the Old Testament, there's this metaphor about, you know, that there was this tower that the man was trying to build to arrive to heaven, and God, you know, just get mad, and then he creates different languages in order to make the human beings not communicate between each other, and the civilization collapsed, basically. Mm-hmm. So I thought that Babel was a good kind of synthesis, a name that will synthesize metaphorically what the film was about.
Babel director Alejandro González Iñárritu last month in Boston. Well, since then, there's been an industry debate about the film that gives us entree into the sometimes difficult world of collaboration. And we want to touch on that for a moment. A couple of Sundays ago, New York Times film critic Terrence Rafferty published an article that highlighted a split between Mr. González Iñárritu and the Babel screenwriter Guillermo Arriaga. The two have had a longtime working partnership, including the highly acclaimed 21 Grams and Amores Perros. But reportedly, Mr. Arriaga, the writer, felt he hasn't been given enough credit. Well, the studio behind Babel took out an ad in the New York Times in response, but has acknowledged that the two men don't intend to work together in the future. Joining us on the line is Boston Globe movie critic Ty Burr. Ty, is this a common complaint of screenwriters?
Oh, I think the screenwriters have been complaining since the dawn of the sound era that they don't get enough respect. And I think actually this particular event and the controversy pokes a welcome hole in the whole notion of the auteur theory, that the director is the sole authorial voice on a film. Film is a hugely collaborative medium.
Well, Terrence Rafferty writes, it seems to him that the ideas in Babel are the screenwriters, Arriaga's, but director Iñárritu's vibrant directorial style changes the tone and, for the most part, changes it for the better. So it sounds as if they are their own yin and yang. How much of a loss for filmmaking is it if these guys split up?
It's open to interpretation. It depends on the movies they make. I think it's difficult to pull apart the strands of who did what, especially in a collaboration that's as close as that. And actually, it could be good for both of them to work with other, you know, for Arriaga to work with another director and Iñárritu to work with a different screenwriter to recharge their batteries and take them in different directions. Mm-hmm. I mean, of the three films they've made, I personally feel like Amores Perros is the strongest, and Babel, as ambitious as it is, primarily because it is so ambitious, is the least of the three films.
Well, I was going to ask you just saw it. Does that mean that you don't like it?
It didn't work entirely for me. I think there were some brilliant bits in it, some very strong acting, and some incredible images. Iñárritu is a heck of a filmmaker. For me, it felt like it was this year's Crash on a global scale, in that it's a movie that's important and never stops telling you it's important and loses sight of some human moments in its, rush to deliver a very big message.
Well, I kind of liked it.
This is one of those movies that's going to divide people and be controversial, because some people will come out of it feeling profoundly moved, and some people will feel they've been speechified at.
Well, and maybe if you're right, it has something to do with two auteurs trying to out-auteur each other.
Mm-hmm. And you can actually feel the strain in the relationship in the movie.
Huh. Well, Ty Burr, the audiences will decide this weekend. Boston Globe movie critic Ty Burr, thanks so much.
Sure. My pleasure, Robin.
I really liked it. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.